Hello, my name is Peter. Welcome to this week's edition of Connecticut Connections, a quick review of some of this week's top news stories from around our state. Our first article was posted to the City of Hartford online service on April 17th. It's written by John Moritz, and it's titled, Siberian Husky Gets Nod as Official Dog of Connecticut. The UConn Huskies may be the champions of college basketball, but the Siberian Husky is the new King of Connecticut, almost. As members of the NCAA champion men's basketball team mingled about the state capitol on Wednesday, lawmakers took the first step to officially designate the Husky as the state dog of Connecticut, joining the pantheon of state symbols that includes the mountain laurel, sperm whales, and Revolutionary War hero Nathan Hale. The legislation, House Bill 5304, passed the House by a vote of 128-18 and now heads to the Senate. Among the concerns raised by the opponents of the bill were the time spent debating a trivial topic as well as the un-American origins of the Husky breed. Like many of Connecticut's state symbols, the bill began as a push by elementary school students in Fairfield several years ago to designate an official state candy. Lawmakers landed on the lollipop for that spot this year, beating out a push by proponents of the orange-based Pez brand and added the popular Huskies for good measure. Joining the push for legislation was UConn's mascot, Jonathan the 15, himself a purebred, Canadian-born Siberian Husky, who delivered forceful, articulate, and excellent testimony to a legislative committee last month, said State Representative Matt Blumenthal, Democrat from Stanford. It was extraordinarily compelling, Blumenthal joked. Even more compelling most recently was the excellent performance of both the men's and women's basketball teams for the University of Connecticut. A last-minute amendment added the bill on Wednesday would establish a working group to examine the future of one of Connecticut's more controversial symbols, the invasive, predatory praying mantis that serves as the official state insect. The working group will include at least two students who have expressed an interest in alternative candidates for the mantis title, the spring azure butterfly and the autumn meadowhawk dragonfly. The group will submit its final report to the legislature in early 2025. The next article was published in the Journal Enquirer on April 18th. It's written by Jamila Young, and it's titled, Connecticut Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Desperate Need of Volunteers. When Pat Okonis reached out for guidance to support a family member with mental illness, she found the help she needed through the Connecticut Chapter of the National Alliance of Mental Illness. I wanted to learn about the disease and how I could support them. Okonis of Newington signed up for NAMI's Family to Family program, an 8-week course that educates families and friends of those with mental illness. There she found not only the information that she needed, but the desire to help others dealing with the same concerns she had. Today, Okonis has taken what she's learned and has become a NAMI staff member herself, serving as administrative coordinator and volunteering as an instructor for the Family to Family class held Wednesdays at the Center Congregational Church in Manchester. The Family to Family program is just one of the many services NAMI offers, and with the increasing demand for such programs, the Connecticut chapter is in desperate need of more volunteers like Okonis. NAMI Connecticut Education Program Director Iris Alamo is requesting more volunteers. NAMI currently holds classes throughout Connecticut, including in Manchester, Milford, Newington, Norwich, and the Farmington Valley, with 200 active volunteers. But Alamo said she would like to expand its services to Litchfield County, Torrington, Bridgeport, Salisbury, Danbury, and Eastern Connecticut. However, more classes means more volunteers. Due to the popularity of the Family to Family program, Alamo said the spring session quickly filled up for classes taught in Manchester and Milford, with each class accommodating up to 15 participants. We have people who travel quite a way to take the classes. They get really good word of mouth. A lot of providers and other organizations recommend people to come to the classes. We've never canceled because of there not being enough people. That's never the case. Alamo said that with more volunteers, the Family to Family program would expand to another session sometime this year. More volunteers allow us to expand our programs in the existing communities, and we also need a presence in communities that lack NAMI programs. For Okonis, she went through 2 days of training from a curriculum developed by the NAMI organization, which Alamo called intense training. The training included the basics of how to run the class, how to handle problem situations, effective communications, and problem solving. They keep it current, and we have to follow manuals and curriculum they give us. We're not inventing anything. Alamo said those interested in becoming a volunteer or staff member must be at least 18 years old. Staff members must have related work experience and education, and volunteers must identify either as someone with a mental health condition or as a family member or caregiver of somebody with a mental illness. What makes a good volunteer is dedication to be part of a national movement helping people and family members who live with or have a family member with mental illness and time, empathy, commitment, and fidelity to the model of our programs and groups. Okona said that based on the feedback she has received on the family-to-family class, she feels those who've taken the class feel better prepared for a future crisis. They learn about crisis management, who to call. They often say they appreciate the topics and how to communicate with loved ones effectively. Her advice for anyone helping someone in their life who has a mental illness is to learn to use empathy for the person's situation, not sympathy, and to never give up hope that your loved one will be able to have a good life. Our next article was posted to the Town of Scotland online service on April 18th. It's written by Jesse Leavenworth, and it's titled, A Small Connecticut Town Has a Zip Code Identity Crisis. For years, people in the eastern Connecticut town have suffered the confusion of fragmented mailing addresses that assign most residents zip codes outside town lines. Randy Danberg, for example, lives on Hanover Road in Scotland, but his mail must bear a zip code from Baltic, a village in neighboring Sprague. Getting deliveries here was just a nightmare, says the 19-year-old resident. In fact, this tiny town with a population of 1,500 has six zip codes, and all but one covering the town center, 06264, are from neighboring towns and villages. The resulting muddle has stalled and complicated every kind of transaction from registering a car to receiving packages, said former First Selectman Gary Greenberg, who has long lobbied for a solution. Now, U.S. Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, and U.S. Representative Joe Courtney, Democrat from the 2nd District, have proposed bicameral legislation to give Scotland one unifying zip code. The bills were reintroduced in the House and Senate in March. Scotland's fragmented zip code system not only undermines the town's identity, but also impairs the timely and accurate delivery of mail and bottlenecks routine processes that residents rely on their zip code for, like the delivery of absentee ballots or notices from the town hall. I look forward to working with local and federal partners to see the legislation through and solve this problem once and for all. As soon as I heard that Scotland had been struggling to fix this issue on their own, I wanted to help, Murphy said. This bill is a simple piece of legislation that would establish a single, unique zip code and put an end to this year's long headache once and for all. Across the nation, there are 41,683 zone improvement plan codes, a system that started in 1963. In parochial Connecticut, two or more zip codes in one town is common, reflecting villages and sections that in some cases are more prominent than the incorporated municipality. But the chronic hodgepodge in Scotland is different because the mailing codes for most people are outside the town's boundaries. Details on how the jumble developed are eye-glazing, Greenberg said, but the system is a holdover from the days of rural free delivery to farms, which started at the turn of the last century. People in the center of Scotland were assigned a local zip code, but outlying residents got codes from Canterbury, Hampton, Wyndham, and Sprague. Currently, the town center post office serves box holders in about 20 residences, Greenberg said, while the rest of Scotland's 625 houses have five different zip codes. Russell Perry, owner of Perry Motors in the center of Scotland, and two men who had stopped by to visit Wednesday morning spoke of people getting jury duty notices for New London court because while Scotland is in Wyndham County, their mailing addresses are in neighboring Sprague, part of New London County. Puzzled delivery drivers also are common. It's been a mess for years. Delivery companies and some government entities use the Postal Service's address database, so the confusion mesticizes throughout the data industrial complex, making it difficult to establish residency, get your motor vehicle tax bills, find a house with GPS, get a passport, get your solar panels turned on, know where to vote, or even in one case, know where to send your kids to school. One family sent a child to the wrong school for years, he said, and on top of that, it's impossible to keep accurate public health, unemployment, and other statistics as they are sorted by zip code, or even, if you are a local official, to know who lives in your town. Packages are routinely returned or delivered to the wrong addresses, and the same named streets compound the problem. Plains Road in Scotland, for example, is handled by the Wyndham Center Post Office, but there's also a Plains Road in Wyndham. People on the two different roads know each other's business well, said Greenberg. About 3 years ago, the Postal Service tried a remedy that allowed some residents to add Scotland to their mailing address along with their assigned out-of-town zip code, but that just caused more confusion. Asked for comment about the bills introduced to Congress, Postal Service spokesperson Amy Gibbs said, they still have to go through postal. It takes a lot to change a zip or a zip code boundary. Zip codes are a postal function so we can deliver mail effectively. Gibbs referred to the Postal Service's boundary review process for changing a zip code. But Greenberg, who left office in 2023, said town officials went through that process and got nowhere. Congressional action to approve a single zip code is the path forward, promising less headaches, better record keeping, and better service for the people who call Scotland home. Current First Selectman Dana Barrow said he supports the effort to give the town a single zip code, 110%. The change would remove confusion and frustration for residents and town workers and stop, for example, death certificates and car tax bills going to the wrong towns. Barrows acknowledged, however, that some people in town do not favor the change. Danberg, the Hanover Road resident, said that he is in that camp. After many headaches and phone calls navigating the split between the actual residence and mailing address, things are working smoothly now, and he is getting his mail and his packages. If his address is changed, however, and he has to adopt a new zip code, he says he fears renewed confusion. I don't have a problem anymore, the retiree said. Everybody is now educated. Our next article was posted to the City of Hartford online service on April 18th. It's written by Ken Dixon, and it's titled, Connecticut State Capitol Has Broken Elevators, Escalators. The final few weeks of the legislative session isn't an optimal time for elevators, escalators, and the moving floor between the state capitol and adjacent legislative office to break down. But that is what has happened as the equipment recently reached its lifetime and the public and lawmakers gingerly navigate the historic halls. The estimated price tag might exceed $10 million. James Timbarrell, the executive director of the Office of Legislative Management, which administrates the 14-acre campus, said that several elevators, escalators, and one of the two moving floors between the Capitol and Legislative Office building are currently broken. As with many 40-year-old buildings, our elevators, escalators, and travelator are all approaching their end of life, some sooner than others. We have our vendor constantly trying to keep up with the repairs, but as you've noticed, not very successfully. We are working with a consultant to determine the cost to fix all of them. He said that his office last month asked for $8 million for repairs in the capital budget that would take effect on July 1st. Senator Kathy Austin, Democrat from Sprague, co-chairwoman of the Budget Writing Appropriations Committee, who earlier in the session used a scooter to elevate a leg while recovering from an injury, said that the capital complex is tough enough to get around even without the broken equipment. One of the out-of-service elevators is in the garage of the Legislative Office Building, where most of the public parks to participate in hearings and meetings with lawmakers. Austin noted that the escalators up into the Capitol's first floor and back down are too narrow for federal Americans with Disability Act requirements. She said that the total price tag is about $10 million, possibly more, with the garage elevator. If someone has ADA issues, it's almost impossible to get around right now, said Austin, who is also a member of the State Advisory Capital Preservation and Restoration Commission. On Thursday, dozens of disability advocates planned a two-hour demonstration on the south grounds of the state capitol, starting at 1 p.m., to push for further state funding for state health programs, wheelchair repairs in the home, and accessible medical examination equipment. Deborah Dorfman, executive director of the Hartford-based federally funded nonprofit Disability Rights CT, which is not involved in the Tuesday demonstration, stressed that federal law requires equal access for disabled people to visit the Capitol complex. Having access to participate is really important, Dorfman said in a Wednesday afternoon phone interview. It's not good enough just to say you could watch on Zoom or listen on the phone. That is excluding people with disabilities. So just like anyone else, people need the opportunity to participate in the legislative process as much as anybody else. It's segregating people with disabilities. If a person wants to be there in person, they have the right to participate in person. This country has a long history of segregating disabled people and segregating them to a lesser experience in any number of contexts. Our next article was posted to the Associated Press online service on April 18th. It's written by Jordan Fenster, and it's titled, Cannabis in Connecticut. They once had a secret handshake. Now, this CT men have a cannabis production facility. Brian Fay and Art Linares have known each other for a long time. Fay was the operating partner at Lenny and Joe's Fishtail, a well-known New Haven restaurant that fell victim to the pandemic. His business partner in that venture was Linares' father. I used to babysit him, Faye said, of Linares. I used to call him my best friend, and we had a secret handshake, Linares said. Both Faye and Linares, a former Connecticut state legislator who is married to Stanford Mayor Caroline Simmons, have worked in real estate for most of their careers. The two are now founders and owners of Rodeo Cannabis, which consists of a 250,000 square foot outdoor cannabis farm and a cannabis production facility. A lot of cannabis is real estate, getting the local permits and approvals, said Linares. To put the production facility and run it, Fay and Linares turned to Alex Knight Hernandez. He's now their vice president of operations, but he was kitchen manager of Lenny and Joe's and was a State Department of Correction employee working at the Bridgeport Correctional Center as a kitchen supervisor, doing a lot of large-scale food production handling. A couple thousand gummies isn't that far off, he said. When we were opening this place, I told Art, I got the perfect guy. It took me a while to get him out of the corrections. The production facility is so new that during a recent tour, employees were churning out the very first vape cartridges and gummies in the hopes of getting them on the shelves by April 20th. Though they do have plans to expand into other methods of production for now, Rodeo is specializing in what's referred to as live rosin, a chemically free process often considered a superior cannabis product as it uses no solvents in the extraction process. Linares and Faye said they believe theirs is the only facility dedicated to producing the rosin consistently. Right now, customers have to drive to Massachusetts to get rosin. The cannabis is harvested and then flash frozen at their farm and shipped across the state to the Sterling facility in 5-pound blocks. They're planting now and hope to harvest 50,000 pounds of cannabis come harvest time. The flower, as it's called, is then washed in a near-freezing bath that agitates the plant material so that tiny hair is called trichomes, where the majority of the THC resides, come free. The washing machine, called the Hashitron, turns out a pale, foamy slurry, which is freeze-dried to become a sand-like substance known as bubble hash. That bubble hash is pressed to exude thick, sticky, pure THC, which is then melted and decarboxylates the hash oil. The oil is what then you can infuse into edibles. That's what you're seeing in vape carts. That's your usable intermediary product. The hash oil is irradiated to remove any microbes and injected into vape cartridges or mixed into cannabis edibles. For every 5,000 pounds of cannabis biomass, they are able to produce about 3,200 grams of usable oil, a little more than 7 pounds. The vault at Rodeo will slowly get filled, but for now it's largely empty housing only, the company's very first products coming off the line. Those first products will be offered to any and all legal dispensaries and wish to carry them. The feedback so far has been very positive, especially with the live rosin, Linares said. They've all reached out, and they're excited to get their hands on the product. Rodeo has applied for zoning approval to open a dispensary in Shelton. So far, local zoning officials have been reluctant to move forward on the application, but Linares is confident. We've invested $14 million between the sun-grown farm, the $3 million license fee, the lab, and all the operating expenditures. We expect to do well with this business, and when we're able to open up Shelton, it will only improve. Connecticut currently has only 6 licensed cannabis growers actually putting products on shelves, but more are in the pipeline, which means the landscape may change. In Massachusetts, which has no statewide caps on the number of available licenses, the price of cannabis has plummeted. We're getting job applications from folks in Massachusetts because companies either closed or they're not happy there. In Mass, people are really struggling where we're seeing equipment being fire sold and we're seeing people looking to work here. Faye and Linares are hoping to carve themselves a niche in the Connecticut cannabis marketplace, serving as a processing facility, particularly due to their focus on solventless process. We've invested heavily in this manufacturing lab so that we can help other growers process their flower, Linares said. They also sell cannabis wholesale to other licensed producers who don't have their own cultivation facilities. The processing facility is new, but the farm itself has already churned out 30,000 pounds of cannabis. We plan on doing that consistently, so any other small food and beverage or small manufacturer that's looking for biomass to process themselves, we will sell them fresh, frozen products as well, including even the big guys. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on April 15th. It's written by Sean Crossfix, and it's titled, Connecticut Grocery Store is Closing After 83 Years. The Middlebury staple business, Four Corners Grocery Store, announced last weekend that the store will be closing after 83 years and word quickly spread around town. DeNova recently accepted an offer to lease the land to Dollar General and will be fully moved out by May 1st, although it's likely the store will be closed before with a 35% sale, with some exceptions this upcoming week. The pandemic hit and changed everything, DeNova said. We didn't get the same customer count anymore. It's not that they didn't want to come to see you. Their lives just changed. All of a sudden, they had more varieties and more options. I would have never thought of calling my favorite restaurant and asking them to put some meals together and I can come pick them up. That became another factor. And you have to remember that there's only 21 dinners a week. The question is, how many do you get? You have McDonald's, you have pizza places, you have grinder places, then you have to factor in Uber Eats and Grubhub. DeNova said the customers stayed loyal during the pandemic with curbside orders, but the price of doing business has also gone up. It's expensive to run a small business, especially a one-store operation. Four Corners has been in its current location since 1982. Minimum wage going up in Connecticut didn't help at all. It went up to $15 and now is $15.69. Electric bills aren't any cheaper, and insurance prices have gone through the roof, and taxes aren't any better. You're squeezing your margin every day. When your sales slow down, you're not bringing enough money in. Don't forget, the credit card companies, they are everyone's partner now, and they get 2.2% of everyone's gig. Everyone becomes your partner, the banks, insurance companies, credit card companies, and the government. It never stops. In stepped Dollar General with an offer to DeNova that he decided to accept. They made me an offer. My equipment is old. I was looking at a remodel myself. The stuff isn't cheap anymore. Just a compressor system to run the store is $250,000. It's 70 years old and it was going to be big bucks. DeNova said Dollar General Markets will move in. Dollar General Markets are typically double the size of a standard Dollar General location. Another big difference is that they sell produce, dairy products, perishable foods, and meats, according to the company. DeNova was told by Dollar General that five DGM locations are at various stages of moving into the state. In addition to Middlebury, locations are expected in Essex, Thomaston, Litchfield, and Manchester. The Essex location at 125 Westbrook Road opened earlier this year. DeNova informed his workers, including nine full-timers, of the news last weekend. I've had people with me as many as 30 years, DeNova said. My people are the best, and I'm going to miss them the most. They were sad. They all said they would stay with me until the end. We've developed a good bond. Naugatuck resident Dawn Sorois has worked at the store for 22 years and recently found out about the store closing. She's mainly worked in the deli and kitchen. Joe treated me like family from day one. They also helped me whenever I needed a day off. It was a special place. I'm going to miss working there. DeNova is part of the fabric of the community. The lifelong Middlebury resident seemed to know everyone in town. Why wouldn't he? He started his work at the store as a 9-year-old. Many of his workers are the children of people he's seen his entire life. He said the outpouring of phone calls and well wishes has made him feel very good. It's been very touching. I grew up in the grocery business. This was my grandfather and father's store. I've seen so many generations coming through. Then they had kids, and I would hire their kids. I'm 70 years old, and I started basically when I was 9. So you just know everybody. They all come in and say how happy they are for me because they know how hard we work. This is a 7-day-a-week job. You are here every holiday. I've never experienced a family holiday. By the time you get done, you are exhausted and want to sleep. You wake up in the morning, you do some festivities, and the next morning you come back and open up. Although he will still oversee the property, DeNova said his wife Lucy is having the couple, happy the couple will be able to spend Thanksgiving and Christmas together for the first time, and they also plan to travel. The couple has 2 daughters, Stephanie and Emily. Stephanie previously worked in a store and ran the kitchen. Her husband, Tim, ran the meat department. It's an end of an era for my family. We put a lot of time into this. It's bittersweet. You know all the customers. If you do something for so long, you don't know if you can do anything else. Longtime customer Barbara Henson said she was sad to hear the store was closing. This store has been here since I was a kid. It's always sad when you lose something in your hometown. It will be missed. Joe's family and the people that worked here made it special. It was a great local store where everybody saw everybody. It was nice. It was a great place, and we were all sad to see it go. Fellow Middlebury resident Jennifer Tramontano said Four Corners was always the place to go. It was family-owned and operated, and everyone was friendly. There was always fresh meat at the deli. We're all going to miss this. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on April 15th. It's written by Justin Mizinski, and it's titled, Connecticut Protesters Block Entrances to Pratt & Whitney Factory. Protesters blocked the entrances to Pratt & Whitney Factory in Middletown on Monday morning over the war in Gaza. Protesters are demanding that Pratt & Whitney end the company's contract with Israel and all exports to Israel immediately and begin the transition to a peace-based economy where the engines will not enable war and genocide. The group that organized the demonstration, which only identified itself as an independent group. According to the group, about 50 protesters took part in the demonstration. A spokesperson for the demonstrator said the protest was made up of an autonomous group of activists from across the state and was not organized by any specific organization. This demonstration is part of a nationwide effort to target companies complicit in the arming of the Israeli military during its assault on Gaza, and is also in solidarity with A15 Action, a coordinated economic blockade in over 30 cities around the world on April 15th. Pratt & Whitney produces the engines used in multiple Israeli warplanes that bomb Gaza, including engines produced and tested at the Middletown factory. The company is also engaged in a 15-year contract with the Israel Ministry of Defense and has been supplying Israel with military aircraft since 1947. Israel would not be able to do this without Pratt & Whitney and their parent company, RTX. The Middletown Police Department did not immediately respond to any inquiries seeking details about its response to the demonstration and whether any arrests have been made. A spokesperson for Pratt & Whitney did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on April 15th. It's written by Stephen Underwood, and it's titled, Armed Patrols in Hartford Plan to Expand Downtown. As the UConn Husky men's basketball team marched in downtown Hartford for the official victory parade on Saturday, a small group of armed citizens marched down Garden Street in the city's north end. They weren't there to celebrate UConn's historic win. They were there to take back their neighborhood. The energy being poured into sporting celebrations is admirable and well-deserved, but if state and city leaders prioritize crime-fighting measures for Hartford in the same manner, then we would all have a community that is safe, enjoyable, progressing, and one that we can be proud of, said Reverend Dexter Burke, senior pastor of the Walk in the Light Church of God. Burke and Reverend Cornell Lewis, Self-Defense Brigade, have been patrolling the area of Garden and Nelson Streets for the last 6 weeks after a double homicide back in February. Around 30 armed civilians take part in the patrols that march up and down the street throughout the various hours of the day. Lewis and the group continues to add new members. Lewis, a former minister who started the brigade as a solution to the city's crime, organizes the daily patrols. The group of armed citizens who all have legal permits to conceal carry have so far installed 75 security cameras in various homes along Garden Street. Lewis, who also wears a body camera similar to police officers with two pistols concealed under his white Block Watch t-shirt, also flies a drone for surveillance around the neighborhood. "Armed citizen patrol," Lewis shouts into a blue megaphone as he walks down the street. "Armed citizen patrol on duty." Lewis and Burke, who have both called the patrols successful in helping keep the streets safe, said they will be expanding their reach across the city to the downtown area. Burke said store owners in the downtown and around Duncan Park have asked the self-defense brigade for their help patrolling around their shops. The group has not received feedback from residents in the downtown yet. "We believe the residents of those areas shouldn't have to give up permission to fight crime. We believe that anywhere where crime is, we have an authority and an obligation to fight it. So we're not waiting for anyone. The criminals don't have to ask to commit crime in the neighborhood. Why should we have to ask anyone to fight it? Store owners downtown are locking their doors in between customers coming into their shops because of the crime and theft. They want security down there." Downtown Hartford, with its largely commuter population, is the financial heart of the city, with several companies like Travelers Insurance that employ hundreds of workers from around suburbs. The area also has one of the lowest crime rates in the city, according to the Hartford Police. "We don't see too much violent crime downtown," said Lieutenant Aaron Busford, Hartford Police spokesperson. "It's not a high problem area." But while the group has called the patrols successful, the city has criticized the armed patrols as unnecessary and harmful. Mayor Arunan Arulapalam previously said in a statement that he believes more guns on the streets is not the answer. "Our community has seen so much pain and trauma, and what we need is for those who love the city to do the hard work of healing that pain, not walk around our streets with guns trying to take the law into their own hands." Other groups in the city, like Mothers United Against Violence, have also criticized the patrols as harmful. Arulapalam, who recently created an Office of Violence Prevention, has said the way to stem violence is through intervention and creating more opportunities for education and employment for the city's most vulnerable populations. Lewis, who said the mayor has not yet reached out to him, blasted Arulapalam for his response to the patrols and said he plans on expanding them across the city as the groups grow larger. "He needs to stop criticizing us and find real solutions to these problems," Lewis said. "Crime is not getting better, and no office is going to make it better. We're here because nothing else is working. We're not going to stop." While Hartford experienced a sharp increase in shootings in 2020 and 2021, the numbers decreased last year and are now showing a two-year decline. In 2023, there were 98 non-fatal shooting victims, less than half of the 211 Hartford saw in 2020. And the number was down by 28% from 2022, according to a report in the former Mayor Luke Bronin's transition binder. But while the number of non-fatal shooting victims last year was lower than any year since 2006, homicides still remain high. There were 28 homicides from gun violence in Hartford in 2023. While that's a significant drop from 39 homicides in 2022, it remains higher than in 2019 when 23 people were killed by gun violence in the city. Hartford residents Jennifer and Sean Lopinto, who both live in the city's south end, came out to join Lewis and Burke on patrol. The pair, who learned about the patrols from the pro-gun lobby Guns Owners of America, said they were interested in learning more. "This is not just about the south end or the north end. We should be one community," Jennifer Lopinto said, walking down Garden Street. "Violence can happen in any neighborhood, and being here really is important. It's something that gets me riled up, so I wanted to put my money where my mouth is." Lewis said the self-defense brigade will begin patrols around Duncan Park starting next weekend. Our next article was posted to the CT.insider online service on April 16th. It's written by Alex Putterman, and it's titled, "Does Connecticut Law on Racial Balance in Schools Need an Overhaul?" Connecticut's controversial law regarding racial balance in local school districts could be in for an overhaul. Under a bill that has advanced out of two legislative committees, the state's education department would study potential changes to the law, with enforcement paused until the review is complete. That would mean the towns of Fairfield, Greenwich, West Hartford, and Hamden, who each currently have at least one school out of compliance with the law, would be off the hook, at least temporarily, from explaining to state officials how they plan to better integrate their school systems. Representative Jennifer Leeper, Democrat from Fairfield, was responsible for the provision regarding racial balance, which is included in the broader education bill. Leeper said on Friday she has grown frustrated with the existing racial balance law, which requires non-white students be distributed relatively evenly across the school district instead of concentrated in certain schools. Typically, the schools out of compliance with the law are those in majority white towns that have a significant number of non-white students. Really, the schools that are probably models of inclusivity and integration are the ones getting identified by the law, where we know we have racial isolation happening at the vast majority of other schools, otherwise that are not captured by this law. Leeper argued racial imbalance in some schools largely reflected the issues around zoning, including where people choose to live, where people can afford to live, where we allow for more diversified housing stock. Under the proposed bill, the Education Department would study the effectiveness of existing racial balance policies, assess how those policies have affected students of color and purpose, and propose alternative methods for correcting racial imbalances. Representative Jeff Curry, Democrat from East Hartford, who co-chairs the legislature's Education Committee, said pausing enforcement of the racial balance law would give the state time to examine the law and then be able to come back and see how to best make decisions at the local level. Under the new proposal, the study would be due by January 1st, 2026. Connecticut's racial balance law, passed in 1969 and updated several times throughout the decades, requires that each public school in a given district fall within 25 percentage points of the overall district's share of white and non-white students. If a town is 70% white, for instance, each individual public school there must be between 45 and 95% white. Districts with at least one school out of compliance with the law are required to submit and implement plans for how they plan to achieve better balance moving forward. Over the years, the law has drawn criticism from numerous directions. Officials in districts affected by the law often complain that it forces them to move kids from their neighborhood schools, creating unnecessary disruption. Some integration advocates, meanwhile, have wondered why the state enforces racial balance only within a given school district as opposed to regionally. Those who support the law typically acknowledge its limitations but argue state oversight is necessary to keep districts from confining students of color to one or two schools while leaving other buildings almost entirely white. In practice, the racial balance law tends to affect only a narrow subset of towns, those with a substantial number of non-white students, but not enough that they're spread across the school district. Last year, the state reported five schools out of compliance, two in Greenwich and one each in Fairfield, West Hartford, and Hamden, as well as 20 additional schools in impending imbalance, meaning they were close to the imbalance threshold. Some of those schools have been out of compliance on and off for decades, submitting plan after plan to state officials, but nonetheless failing to achieve proper balance. At a recent meeting of the State Board of Education, officials from Greenwich criticized the racial balance law, defending the district's diversity and level of integration. We have diversity within our schools, and maybe it doesn't look like diversity with respect to one's outward appearance, but the diversity in culture goes beyond just that, said Karen Kowalski, chair of the town's Board of Education. Charlene Russell Tucker, the state's education commissioner, responded by noting the legislature's proposed bill, saying she didn't know if it would pass, but if it does, it would guide our action with regard to racial balance. In written testimony submitted to the legislature, Russell Tucker didn't weigh in for or against the proposal, but said the Education Department will attempt to conduct such a study that examines the strategies implemented by Connecticut districts to remedy racial imbalance, evaluate their effectiveness and cost benefits, and explore other alternatives. The proposed bill passed out of the Education Committee in mid-March, then out of the Appropriations Committee in early April. It now advances to the broader legislature, which has until May 8th to act on it. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on April 16th. It's written by Pamela Brown, and it's titled, "This Connecticut Bakery Has a Nordic Flair." The Connecticut Baking Company focuses on Nordic-style baked goods, and that includes everything from breads to sweet treats. at Spruce and Rye Baking Company, an artisanal microbakery in West Hartford. They use traditional methods and techniques with organic ingredients and no preservatives, according to their owners. That means baking unique, handmade Nordic-inspired breads, buns, sweets, and pastries in a modern yet minimalist way, featuring a palette of bold colors. Artisanal bakeries offer a more curated and handcraft approach. We use higher quality and better ingredients and give more focus and attention in detail when compared to bakeries with mass production, said owner Joe Patellaro of the Merry Team, including his wife, Lisa, who run the bakery from their home. After spending years gathering old Nordic recipes from their travels across Europe, the couple said their baked goods are all based on recipes or special food memories they discovered along the way. All our items are leavened with sourdough starter, so we don't use commercial yeast. True to our name, every single item in the bakery has rye flour included in it to some degree. Some of their breads' best sellers include Icelandic and Danish rye bread, the two Ravens sourdough made with a rotating roaster of nuts, seeds, and dried fruit, and the Nordeli rye sourdough, a Nordic takeout on a Jewish deli rye. For buns, it's Swedish cardamom buns, Swedish cinnamon buns, and morning buns. For pastries and sweets, it's Tyrbekase, Denmark's version of the almond croissant, Danish jam bars, and rye chocolate chip cookies. Popular cakes include Swedish sticky chocolate cake and Dutch almond cake. All products are made with heritage wheat varieties from Washington State, Oregon, California, a small Swedish island, and oftentimes Maine and Arizona. The couple said the flours prioritize nutrition and flavor, and many varieties are ancient grains that haven't been genetically modified. The old way of stone grinding wheat ensures that the flours incorporate as much of the whole grains as possible while supporting mills that are dedicated to still doing in the old way. Spruce and Rye's signature sourdough loaf, made by hand over the course of 2 days with four different organic high extraction flours. The Patelleros said they realized Nordic baking is new to most Americans. This includes about the uniqueness of the ingredients, complex sounding names, flavor profiles that are not frequently used in American baking, and cultural style of how most Nordic folks enjoy such goodies. There is strong interest from people who have traveled across the Nordic nations and experienced the food there. Several paths led the couple to a fascination with so-called New Nordic cuisine. One was the ascendance of the food movement for about 10 years across Michelin restaurants they frequented in New York City and Europe. The Nordic approach to fine dining is highly localized, ingredient-driven, and presented in a contemporary modern aesthetics. Two concepts the couple said they are attracted to, along with modern art, minimalist interior design, and supporting small rural farms. The couple also noted their interest in bread made by famous restaurants such as Blue Hill at Stone Barns in Blue Hill in New York City, named after the head chef Dan Barber. The Barber bread is made from heritage local grains, and the couple said they are chasing that flavor with every loaf we bake. The Patelleros also said they've enjoyed the cafe and bakery culture throughout New York City that featured high-quality breads, pastries, and coffees, and after moving to West Hartford, baked for themselves and shared their goods with family, friends, and neighbors. After comments poured in from those who got a taste of the baking, they decided to start Spruce and Rye Baking Company. The couple said the bakery's name comes from their fascination with Nordic culture and their baked goods, including the importance of rye flour and the prevalence of trees in the conifer family that cover Nordic forest spruce. The baking is not a full-time job for either member of the couple. Joe Patellaro is chief executive officer and chief investment officer of Northmont Capital Management, and Liza, marketing guru for the bakery, is a senior public relations and digital strategist for Edelman. But the couple said they love working together and bringing a creative passion project to life, which allow them to meet people and join a local community. Given their success, the Patelleros acknowledge the need to start a brick-and-mortar location someday, but there is only so much a two-person team both with 9-to-5 jobs and a very active one-year-old. For now, the couple said they are grateful about demand for their goods. The future might hold a version of Spruce and Rye that would continue the bakery and combine it with an all-day Nordic-inspired cafe. Our next article was posted to the Town of Sterling online service on April 16th. It's written by Jesse Leavenworth, and it's titled, Foreclosure Better Than Fines for Destructive Livestock in Eastern Connecticut Town. A state legislator from the area in Eastern Connecticut where roaming pigs and cattle have damaged crops, fields, and lawns said civil action that could lead to property foreclosure is a better remedy than the current pile of infractions that seem to be stalled in criminal court. Representative Doug Dubitsky, Republican from Chaplin, is among lawmakers working on a bill that emerged from chronic complaints in Sterling and Canterbury about a farming couple with properties in both towns, Ryan and Alicia Salvis, and Radical Foods from Farm LLP, also are defendants in a lawsuit filed this year by Sterling residents over what the plaintiffs contend is tens of thousands of dollars in damage. Wayward cows and pigs have trampled and rooted up residents' lawns and gardens, snapped shrubs, eaten farmers' hay and chicken feed, and caused prolonged frustration for more than 2 years. The Regional Animal Control Authority, the Northeast Connecticut Council of Governments, cited Ryan Salvis with more than 60 counts of violating state law on roaming livestock. Each count carries a possible fine of $95. Those cases are pending in Superior Court in Danielson. But Dubitsky, an attorney who lives on a farm in Chaplin, said the problem would be better approached on the civil side in the same way you have a zoning or health code violation. The appropriate agency can issue a violation and fine, and if you don't pay, the town can go to court and have a judgment and have a lien put on the property. And if you don't pay the lien, after a while, the town can foreclose. Cows from the Radical Roots Farm have been loose in Sterling recently, trampling a garlic patch and eating some of the farmer's silage, Town Zoning Enforcement Officer Victoria Robin Lewis said. Pigs from the farm have not been seen in the kinds of numbers, as many as 22 in one group, as last fall, but they have been sighted in local woods, and the sows are bearing litters in the woods. First Selectman Link Cooper said he expects a return in force of ravaging swine and cattle as the weather warms. There hasn't been a great deal of activity, but it's not going to stay that way. A representative for Radical Foods Farm could not be reached on Monday. A major concern of local officials and state lawmakers is that the loose hogs could go completely wild and start wreaking widespread damage as federal swine have done in other parts of the United States. Senator Heather Summers, a Republican whose district includes Sterling, said she and other officials, including representatives of the state and federal agricultural agencies, met recently to discuss the ongoing problem. A U.S. Department of Agriculture official said during the meeting that the Sterling pigs do not meet the definition of feral. Contacted on Monday, agency spokesperson Tanya Espinoza pointed to the USDA description, which says feral swine may appear similar to the domestic cousins, but often have thicker hides with coarse, bristly hair and longer tusks. Feral hogs can breed year-round and have up to 2 litters of about 4 to 12 piglets each year. The animals are sexually mature at 6 to 8 months of age, so populations can double in size in 4 months, according to the USDA. The Sterling livestock problems are the focus of an ongoing investigation, State Department of Agriculture spokesperson Rebecca Eddy said on Monday. Eddy said that they are engaging with legislators and NUCOG on legislation, but Summers said department officials would not reveal any details about the investigation during the recent meeting. The bill in the current state legislative session calls for the creation of a task force to study the enforcement of current state law on loose livestock in order to prevent the occurrence of certain undesired interactions between roaming swine and bovines. The panel would have to report its findings at the beginning of 2025. But Dubitsky said stakeholders are already discussing the issue and possible remedies, including civil action that he favors. The bill could be amended to accelerate the process and avoid the need for a task force. Disputes over livestock and property fines are centuries old, but Sterling officials and residents who have complained about Radical Roots Farms say Such long-term and unresolved problems with one farm are far outside the norm. Testifying before legislators recently about the proposed bill, NECOG Executive Director John Filchak said that in most cases where a citation for roaming livestock is necessary, one issuance is enough to correct the situation, and there is not a need to move to formal court action. In the Sterling case, however, none of these tickets has seen final action by the court. In the meantime, persons in close proximity to these roaming animals continue to experience property damage and their fear of harm from these animals, raising their frustration level as the case drags on. Our only authority is to issue more tickets. The simple fact is that there is currently not a solution in place whereby local animal control can quickly correct instances where there are repeated instances of roaming livestock or other domestic animals. Our growing belief is that some form of mandatory mediation is what is needed. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on April 16th. It's written by Don Stakem, and it's titled, Homeowners in Connecticut Town Balk at Prospect of Massive Warehouse. A Cromwell-based contractor wants to build a nearly 100,000-square-foot warehouse on wooded property, but is encountering resistance from neighbors. Delta Building Corporation proposes to build on land along Middle Street in Middletown, not far from the Meriden Line, and a small group of homeowners has already signaled that it will push back against the idea at a Wetlands Commission hearing on May 1st. Nearby homeowners are warning that tearing down acres of trees and then constructing a huge building would seriously endanger an ecologically sensitive property. Manthe Brook and Sawmill Brook run nearby and could be subject to flooding if the town allows a large warehouse and surrounding parking to cover the land. Neighbors have sent the Wetlands Commission several videos showing a flooded street, overflowing brooks, and torrents of water pouring across a lawn during heavy rain, saying that previous development in the area has created trouble during major storms. Resident Nick Gianetti, who lives on a four-acre farm at nearby Boardman Lane and Bell Street, is urging town commissions to reject the plan. The risk of flooding to our family home has increased at an alarming level. This hydrological system does not have the capacity to receive runoff from additional impervious surface. The forest and wetland provide critical buffer capacity to manage precipitation. A small crowd showed up for the Wetlands Commission's April 3rd meeting, where Delta was scheduled to present its case, but Representative Gary Deharsh asked for an extension until May 4th. Our wetlands consultant isn't available this evening. From most of the comments I've heard about the project and the written testimony by one of the neighbors, a lot of things that need to be discussed really need to be handled by the wetlands consultant. The commission announced the hearing would be rescheduled to May 1st. I know a lot of the public is here wanting to hear their presentation. Unfortunately, the specialist and the engineer aren't able to make it tonight. James Sipperly, the town's environmental planner, said at the meeting, if the members of the public want to state something, you can, but it's kind of putting the cart before the horse because we haven't heard from the applicant what the proposal is. Sipperly said information about wetland evaluation assessments, a natural diversity database, and studies of drainage and water retention would all be reviewed on May 1st. Nobody spoke, but several people submitted letters to the commission. Sean Merrill, a Sawmill Road homeowner, said the warehouse roadway alone would destroy 3,000 square feet of wetlands. The roadway will serve no purpose to the city of Middletown or its residents. Why must 3,000 square feet of wetlands be destroyed for the sole benefit of only company with only 20 employees? The property should be converted into open space consistent with the governor's push to expand recreational areas and the contiguous multi-use trail system. The city claims to be in favor of sustainable development, environmental protection, climate resistance. Therefore, the city should take a stance and protect one of the last sections of open space adjacent to the critical habitat and water resources. Opinion was more varied in a lengthy debate on a Facebook community page devoted to Middletown. Some owners followed the opposition's line of argument, but others said Middle Street area is already partly industrial and that the town could use additional revenue to form a warehouse. Delta Building is anticipated to go before the Planning and Zoning Commission May 8 to present its request for a site plan approval. Our next article was published in the Hartford Current on April 16th. It's written by Ed Stenard, and it's titled Anti-Semitic Incidents Rise to Record Numbers in Connecticut. A number of anti-Semitic incidents in Connecticut rose to record-setting highs in 2023, according to the Anti-Defamation League, with incidents of harassment and vandalism more than doubling. There were 184 anti-Semitic incidents recorded in the state, up from 68 in 2022, a 170% increase. Connecticut was ahead of the national trend, in which 8,800 incidents were recorded last year, a 140% increase. Anti-Semitism is raging in our local communities, in our schools, in the workplace, and on the street, said ADL Connecticut Regional Director Stacy Sobel. Anti-Semitism cannot be a problem only for the Jewish people. It's incumbent upon everyone to stand up and speak out. We call on every person who cares about living in a decent society to reject anti-Jewish hatred. In Connecticut, there were 115 recorded incidents of harassment compared to 55 in 2022 and 69 incidents of vandalism compared to 27 in 2022. Most of the 184 incidents occurred after October 7th attack by Hamas on Israel. There were 41 incidents at Jewish institutions and schools and 31 at other institutions and schools, according to the report. 17 occurred on college campuses. Nationally, assault incidents increased by 45%, vandalism by 69%, and harassment 184%. There were monthly increases in February, March, April, May, and September, each of which broke the record for a single month set in November of 2022. After October 7th, the ADL recorded explicitly anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist rhetoric at 1,300 anti-Israel rallies. Excluding Israel-related incidents, anti-Semitic incidents rose 65% in over the recorded of 2022. After October 7th, a large number of incidents referred to Israel or Zionism or included a swastika, according to the ADL. Our next article was posted to the Hearst Connecticut Media Online Service on April 17th. It's written by Christian Abraham, and it's titled, Sikorsky to Lay Off Hundreds in Connecticut. After the U.S. Army canceled plans for a new armed scout helicopter, Sikorsky is laying off as many as 400 employees in Connecticut, primarily in its engineering and digital technology ranks, who would have developed the chopper. Sikorsky's confirmed the layoffs on Tuesday to CT Insider, with a spokesperson not providing a specific number of workers impacted, but that it equated to less than 1% of parent Lockheed Martin's workforce, which numbered 122,000 people entering this year. One source familiar with the company's plan said the cuts would affect about 350 jobs in Stratford and another 50 elsewhere in Connecticut. We intend to retain as many roles as possible to meet national security commitments and preserve the U.S. rotary wing industrial base, Sikorsky stated in an email forwarded on Tuesday. In addition to Connecticut, where the manufacturer has its headquarters plant in Stratford, layoffs would extend to Sikorsky facilities in other states. It has been well documented that there is a high demand for engineering and tech talent in our state right now, so it's our expectation these workers will be quickly and easily absorbed into our manufacturing ecosystem, Julia Bergman, spokesperson to Governor Ned Lamont, said on Tuesday evening, noting that the governor spoke with Sikorsky CEO on Monday. The state, through the Departments of Community and Economic Development, is working with Sikorsky and other partners to help these impacted, included proactively connecting workers with new job opportunities in the state. While this news is unfortunate, the company remains committed to Connecticut and will continue to be an important contributor to the state's manufacturing and defense sector. The administration has spoken with senior Army officials who have expressed continued and increased support for the Black Hawk program. Sikorsky continues to market Black Hawk helicopters to foreign militaries and is also building a new fleet of cargo helicopters for the U.S. Marine Corps. That's all for this week's Connecticut Connections. This is Peter. So long until next time.